Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. When he was running for president, Bill Clinton surprised Republicans by making welfare reform a major issue. When he failed to follow through, however, the Republicans took the initiative, and in 1996, a Democratic president and a Republican Congress, backed by strong public support, came together to pass the most radical welfare reform bill ever to come out of Washington. This morning, in this first hour of Focus, we'll talk about the making of welfare reform, and our guest is Ron Haskins. He is a senior fellow in the Economic Studies Program and co-director of the Center on Children and Families at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. He's also a senior consultant at the Annie E. Casey Foundation in Baltimore. He's the author of the book Work Over Welfare, the inside story of the 1996 welfare reform law. He was, from February to December 2002, the senior advisor to the president for welfare policy at the White House. And before going to Brookings and Casey, he spent 14 years on the staff of the House Ways and Human Resources Subcommittee, first as welfare counsel to the Republican staff and then as the subcommittee staff director. So he was certainly someone who was very much involved in this welfare reform in 1996. And we'll talk a little bit about how it is that it came about, what people feared might happen, what actually did happen now that we're now 12 years past that point. And of course, questions and comments from people who are listening are welcome. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people do keep their comments and questions brief so that we can keep moving along, getting as many different people in as possible. But certainly, comments, questions from listeners are welcome. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number to call is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, and the call's on us, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, Mr. Haskins, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, thanks, and yourself?
Good.
We appreciate you giving us some of your time.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'd like to start out and talk a little bit about the history of this welfare reform, something that you've written about in your book and in much greater detail, I'm sure, than we will do here. But just to kind of hit the high points. And I think that perhaps the place to start is to talk about how it is and why it is that Mr. Clinton, when he was running, took this issue on. Certainly, it was something that Republicans had been talking about for a long time, going back to the presidency, at least going back to the presidency of Ronald Reagan. And some, I suppose, were surprised that a Democrat should take the position on the issue that he did. I imagine other people within the Democratic Party were not real happy about that. Why was it that Bill Clinton decided that this was going to be a major issue?
I recall that in the early part of the presidential election after Clinton had been nominated, Newt Gingrich was meeting with Clay Shaw, who was the chairman of the Ways and Means Subcommittee that wrote the first draft of the welfare reform bill. And he summoned a fairly senior official from the White House, and Newt told that official to go back to the White House and tell the Bush administration, which was, you know, had been there for 4 years and was running against Clinton for reelection, that they had better beware that Clinton was the most dangerous politician in the country and that he was using welfare reform as one of his lead issues, and he was to the right of the Republican Party, and this was totally unheard of and completely unacceptable. And that's exactly what he did. Some Republicans thought it was sort of a ploy. So did some people in the media. But in fact, I think it's consistent with the whole perspective that he brought to the Democratic Party, that the party was too far left, it had to come back to the center, and that there were major issues like the budget and the deficit, trade, and welfare that he intended to change the you know, at least in recent years, the history of the Democratic Party, which is exactly what he did. And he made enormous progress on all three issues, including the welfare reform bill.
So you would not suggest that the fact that once he got into office, his commitment to this seemed to waver a bit. That would not suggest to you that he, in fact, wasn't really fully committed to the idea.
It didn't to me. I can see that people would say that, and I would imagine you know, a great historian could write and present a case that he did waver. But don't forget that health care was a huge issue. Clinton thought it was a winning issue. A lot of people thought it was a winning issue, and it would be sort of complete the Roosevelt New Deal, that if there were everyone, we had universal health coverage, and Clinton was going to be the man to do it. And, of course, that fell apart and hurt his administration a lot. But meanwhile, he did have a welfare reform task force. It was headed by three of the most prestigious people in the administration, including one of his closest assistants, Bruce Reed. And they worked very hard to produce a bill that was way more radical than anything any other Democrat had produced. So, you could build a strong case that he didn't never waver. Now, the other evidence that he may have wavered a little is that he did veto two bills before he signed the final bill. Mm-hmm. Republicans presented him with two bills in 1995, the first year after they had captured the House and the Senate, and he vetoed both of them, and he signed the bill in 96. And if you wanted to build this case that he wasn't as serious about welfare reform as some people thought, you might cite those vetoes. And then you would say that he finally signed the bill primarily because the presidential election was coming up, and polls showed that the only issue on which Dole and the Republicans were getting much traction was welfare reform. So if he had vetoed it, then Republicans could say three strikes and out. He promised reform welfare. He refused to do it and so forth. So he signed it for that reason. As you know, if you looked at my book, I have a major part of a chapter in which I discuss the reasoning the administration followed, and especially a last-minute conference that the president called in the cabinet room in the White House with his top officials, including several cabinet secretaries, and they spent almost 3 hours discussing whether he should sign the Republican bill. And then after that, he went in the Oval Office with Bruce Reed and with Vice President Gore and others, and made the final decision that he would sign the bill. And he told people in that meeting that he thought he was going to win the presidency. Again, that he would be reelected no matter what he did on welfare. So politics should not be a major consideration. So I think, in my view, the evidence is consistent that starting even when he was governor of Arkansas and all the way through, he was a serious student of welfare and welfare reform, and he did support almost all the reforms in the bill that Republicans passed. Mm.
And I guess also we should talk about what happened in 1994, when Republicans took control of the Congress, and one of the items of the contract, one of the key items of the contract with America, the set of sort of principles or issues that was particularly driven by Newt Gingrich and mm-hmm. other younger, first-time conservative Republicans who came into Congress at the time, welfare reform was one of the items of the contract. So I suppose one could also argue that, or ask this question, that in what way did that put pressure on the White House to push the president to act that he might – did it lead him to do something that he might not have if Democrats had continued to hold the Congress?
This is one of the things I consider this to be typical of all American history. There are so many behind-the-scenes stories that people don't usually know about, mm-hmm. and Clinton, of course, is the headline in the story. But the Republican preparation for welfare reform was extensive, elaborate, had been going on for at least 4 years, and primarily under the leadership of Newt Gingrich, who, of course, became the speaker eventually, and then of Clay Shaw, who was the head of the in effect, the Welfare Subcommittee, the Ways and Means Committee, and Bill Archer, who was the chairman of the committee, and many other members of the House, not least Jim Talent, who later became a senator from Missouri, and many of the outside Republican groups, too, conservative groups that lobby in Washington were behind welfare reform. So Republicans did develop an elaborate bill, and as you say, it was part of 10 different bills that were in the contract with America. Now, I have noticed that political scientists and other political observers disagree about the impact that the contract with America had on the election itself. But there is no doubt of the impact it had on Republicans once they took over the House and the Senate. It was the agenda. And in 100 days, all 10 of those bills were rewritten. Hearings were held. markups, you know, where the committees actually devote great attention to bills. Sometimes it takes 2, 3, 4 days to do it, and brought to the floor for extensive debate and voted on. So that was an enormous achievement. And welfare reform was always one of the most popular items on the agenda. And as I say, it was something that Republicans had been working on for at least 4 years. So they were ready with the bill. And yes, I believe, in specific answer to your question, it is a case that the bill pushed Clinton further than he wanted to go. But the major items in the bill, especially those having to do with work and welfare, there were many other more or less independent issues like welfare for non-citizens that had not been a part of the national debate but were very much on the Republican agenda. But on the main items of debate, the work requirements, ending welfare as we know it, 2 years and out, making work pay and so forth, those major items that Clinton largely had defined as a national issue, they were all in the bill. Hmm. So the bill he signed, I think, was further than he would have wanted to go. But let's say, just make up a number, 80% or 85% of the bill were things that Clinton did agree with.
Hmm. And I suppose, too, one would want to make the point that by this point there were significant numbers of Americans who felt that the system as it existed, and here what we're really talking about is one program, basically one program. That's the program that was known as, doesn't exist anymore, but was known as Aid to Families with Dependent Children, AFDC. There was a pretty significant feeling, not everyone felt this way, but a lot of Americans felt that this program just didn't work, that it didn't really help people. There were people who argued that it, in fact, perpetuated poverty, and there was a pretty significant public opinion behind the idea of doing something to change the system as it existed.
I think that's exactly right. I think it actually goes beyond that, the public perception of welfare. I think that the system that we had in Washington, and especially the Aid to Families with Dependent Children program, would never have passed a popular vote in America. The American public would never have established a program like AFDC. And the reason is that it simply gave stuff away, in this case, cash. And, of course, that's what food stamps does, and Medicaid, and housing, and many, many other programs. We have over 300 means-tested programs that provide benefits to poor people. And generally, Americans support benefits for poor people, but they want poor people to work and try to achieve self-sufficiency. If they do that, then Americans are quite willing to be generous. And AFDC had paper requirements and did not really require people to work. And that is the major difference between the old program and the new program that was so controversial in 1996, that there were real teeth. Namely, there was a 5-year time limit, which was unheard of before. Welfare could be permanent. And if you look at the caseload at any minute, at any time, and average across all the people on the caseload back before welfare reform, the average person, over 65% of the people on welfare would eventually be on 8 years or more, and during that time could easily consume $100,000 worth of benefits if you include cash and food stamps and housing and all that. So that was a system that was very, very unpopular with Americans, and all of our political consultants always said you can't go too far on work. So we had a 5-year time limit. We had work requirements that every single person on welfare was subject to a work requirement and had to work at least half time, and some more than that, and that states would be penalized if they didn't meet the work requirement, and that welfare recipients themselves would have their benefit cut. That's called a sanction. So these were real teeth, and the states actually aggressively implemented the law. And there were historic changes that resulted that I presume we'll talk about later.
Yeah, right. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Ron Haskins. He's a senior fellow in the Economic Studies Program and co-director of the Center on Children and Families at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. He's also senior consultant at the Annie E. Casey Foundation in Baltimore. He's the author of the book Work Over Welfare, the inside story of the 1996 welfare reform law. And he's joining us this morning from Washington. Questions are welcome. Questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. There was a great deal of concern when this law was signed about what it would mean for poor people, particularly poor children in the United States. I think the concern was, particularly with the time limit, that there would be some families who would come to the time limit and then they essentially would be destitute. They'd be on the street. Who knows what would be happening. Let's ask the question now, a dozen years after, what actually happened?
Yes, let me mention first, you say that it was controversial. I've been in Washington for over 20 years, and there are very, very few issues, maybe the recent immigration debate approaches it, that has been so bitter and so nasty and so negative. Republicans were regularly accused of being Nazis on the floor of the House of Representatives. The New York Times was especially strident in its criticism. One of their columnists said that Republicans had launched a jihad against the poor. And I'm just touching the surface. Amazing statements about how cruel and mean this bill was. Deliberately cruel, one editorial in the New York Times said. So it really was a very, very bitter debate in Congress. But in the end, the bill passed with an overwhelming bipartisan vote. Over half the Democrats on the Hill supported it, and virtually every Republican, and it was signed by a Democratic president. So it was extremely bipartisan bill. And the results have been, in a major way, have placated the criticisms that were issued before the final law was implemented. The first thing that happened was that the rolls declined. The rolls had virtually never declined before. They almost increased every year. There were a few years that they went down just a little bit, but only a percentage point or two. They are now down in 12 years 60%, and much of that occurred in the first 3 or 4 years. So the rolls declined very rapidly. The second thing that happened was that an enormous number of poor mothers went to work. They did exactly what the public expected them to do and what the welfare reform bill was written to encourage them and, if necessary, force them to do, and that is to aggressively look for work, to take low-wage work, and to take a job and work very close to full-time, which they did. Never married mothers who are the least educated and the least work experienced in the group increased their employment by more than 40% over 5 years. 40%. I mean, this is just an enormous, almost unbelievable increase in work effort by low-income mothers. So, you know, the famous Reagan welfare queen was definitely a thing of the past, if indeed it ever did exist. I mean, there are isolated cases, but it certainly was not the case with most people on the rolls. But these were mothers who really did what the public expected them to do. And as a result of that, we had the first consistent decline in child poverty and overall poverty since the early 1970s. Child poverty declined over 30% over about a five-year period. And most notably, poverty among female-headed families dropped like a rock. Now, this is a crucial point. One of the reasons that the American poverty rate is so hard to fight Senator Edwards did not emphasize this in his campaign, but one of the reasons is that so many of our kids are in female-headed families, and the poverty rate in female-headed families is 5 or in some years 6 or more times the poverty rate of kids in married couple families. So if you increase the percentage of our kids in female-headed families and held everything else constant, you still would have a huge increase in poverty. And that's exactly what happened in the United States. So despite the fact that both federal and state governments were spending lots of money, poverty did not decline until the mothers went to work. And when they went to work, and now this is another very important point, Congress over the years and a series of presidents, not least President Clinton, had developed what I would call a work support system. And this is something Americans don't hear about very often, but these are programs that are designed specifically to help poor and low-income working families. In the old days, if you were on welfare and you went to work, you could lose all your benefits. You could make a reasonable decision to stay on welfare because if you left, you'd lose your cash benefit, your food stamps would be reduced, you immediately would pay 30% of your income if you were in housing. That's what the way the housing program worked. And above all, you could entirely lose your Medicaid benefit and so could your children. All of those things were drastically changed, and most importantly, a program called the Earned Income Tax Credit, which gives a cash benefit to low-income working families, was increased several times on a bipartisan basis, and by 1996, when the bill passed, a low-income working mother making, say, $10,000 or $11,000 a year would get $4,000 if she had two children from the Earned Income Tax Credit. She'd get that in cash. Plus, she'd get about $1,500 in food stamps. And she'd get some help with her child care, and the kids would be covered by Medicaid. So we had Congress had dramatically changed the work support system to provide help to low-income families. And this, of course, raises the number one question, which is, if you have a lot of families that are headed by people with low skills, often school dropouts, do you want them to be on welfare, or do you want them to work and be a working member of society and then subsidize their income because they cannot earn enough to support a family? That's the nature of the American economy. And, of course, we've now taken the second route, and we have a strong work support system, and we have a strong welfare system that requires people to work.
I suppose some people would also make the argument, though, that the improvements that you talked about, that is the decline in welfare rolls and the also the decline in child poverty rates for African-American families, this was made possible also in part with the economic boom that we saw at that time, and that since first the downturn that came in 2001 and then where we are now, that once again there are a lot of people who are not doing well, and this raises questions about whether or not we provide adequate supports for those people who are the most disadvantaged and the hardest hit when we have a time when there's an economic downturn.
Right. I generally agree with that, but we should be very cautious in making these interpretations. First of all, on your first point about the economy, there is no doubt that if Clinton and Republicans wanted to pass welfare reform, they certainly picked a great time for it because the economy of the last half of the 1990s was spectacular. It's the best economy we'd had since the 60s. Huge increases in employment. Even some wage increases at the bottom, which were quite unusual because we'd had over a decade of virtual stagnation at the bottom and, in fact, even decline in wages at the bottom of the scale. So it was a perfect time to enact welfare reform. But I would point out to you that since the recession in 2001, and it wasn't until 2004 that that work completely recovered, the proportion of Americans working from the decline in 2001, that not today we are still 25% below the child poverty level that we had before welfare reform in the early and mid-1990s. So even in a mild recession, the mandatory work requirements did overall produce less poverty than the welfare system itself. So there's, and I think everyone who has looked at this carefully agrees with that. Now, there is one crucial point here. Mm-hmm. Welfare does have flaws. And one of them is that there are a large number of moms who have problems that are, in effect, barriers to work. So they have a lot of kids and have trouble with child care. Sometimes they have addictions. Sometimes they have personality issues. Sometimes they have mental health issues. Sometimes they have physical issues, physical disabilities. And these mothers find it very difficult to work on a consistent basis. There are way fewer than people thought before the bill passed in 1996, but there are a substantial number of these mothers, and they have increased since 1996, so that we have a lot more mothers who have no income from cash welfare and no earnings. And that is a serious issue that we should pay more attention to.
We have several callers, and we want to bring them into the conversation. We're at our midpoint here, and maybe again, just real quick, I'll introduce our guest, Ron Haskins. He's a senior fellow in the Economic Studies Program at the Brookings Institution, where he's also co-director of the Center on Children and Families. He is also senior consultant at the Annie E. Casey Foundation in Baltimore. has written on this issue. He's the author of the book Work Over Welfare, the inside story of the 1996 welfare reform law that was published by the Brookings Institution in 2006, when they were at the 10-year anniversary. And questions welcome again, though we ask, though people be brief to help us out so we can keep things moving along. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. First caller here is in the nearby community of Belgium, line, and this is line number one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I'm not totally sure that this is in part of this bailiwick, but in the community I live next to, there seems to be a serious problem with Section 8. Now, is that part of the welfare situation?
Section 8, you're probably referring to housing.
Yes, sir, I sure am.
It was a very slight part of welfare reform. Housing does frequently come in for criticism from all sides, but it was not a big part of the welfare reform bill.
I see. So that
In fact, as I pointed out, housing really is a problem. It is not very consistent with the work orientation that the welfare system now has. It's one of the least work-oriented programs, and the reason is very straightforward. If you get a Let's say you don't work and you have your housing benefit. If you have cash welfare, you pay 30% of your cash welfare benefit. Now if I go out and get a job and I'm suddenly making, you know, 10 or 12 or 14,000 a year, which most of these mothers are, I have to pay 30% of that money. That's like a 30% tax right off the top. And then plus I have to pay Social Security tax, you know, the FICA taxes and often state taxes, plus I have work expenses. So that is really, that 30% is a big problem, and we need to do something about it.
But that's, is that part of Section 8, or is that?
Yes, no, that's part of the most housing programs, including Section 8.
That doesn't seem to be the way a lot of the programs seem to work in some areas, because they get a voucher to take over, to live in a house that somebody provides, and there doesn't seem to be any payments to them, or very, very.
Well, roughly speaking, there are two kinds of housing programs. One, you do get a voucher, you go into the market, and you find a house, and, you know, it's often a private house, could be an apartment, could be an independent house. And then the other kind of program is you live in public housing, which are built by government and maintained by government to the extent that they're very well maintained. So those are two very different programs, but they both have this 30% provision.
Seems to be done a little bit different here. Well, thank you very much, sir.
All right. We'll sure. go on to talk with someone in Ottawa, Illinois, line number four. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, great topic. You know, instead of blaming, you know, one party over another, let's just blame them both, because nothing ever gets done. And I don't see any sense why every time a bill comes up, let's modify it, you know. It's like they have one bill for another bill for another bill, and that's part of the problem. I know people that are on the welfare system as we speak, including myself, who it pays you not to work. It's actually, in some respects, cheaper not to work than to go through the hassle of trying to find something because of the fact of the cost of living. Now, who do you blame the cost of living for the reason why we're in such dire straits? I'm blaming them, both the Democrats and the Republicans, because they seem to want to spend, and tax to death. Now, take, for instance, this money we're all getting back. How much you want to bet next year will be all taxed for that, on top of other things? Property taxes are going through the roof. I think that's basically everybody's problem. And yet we're giving freebies to illegal immigrants. And you look at California, Texas, Arizona, and Nevada, and see, tell me that there isn't a big problem with the labor and with the welfare system there. It's broken. And every time somebody brings up the idea to fix it, it doesn't matter which side of the fence, and they're both in bed with each other, nothing ever gets done. Why is that? I'll get off and listen. Thank you, guys.
Okay, first of all, this 1996 legislation is an example that things do get done in Washington. It was one of the biggest pieces of social legislation ever enacted. It was radical reform of the type that people thought was impossible. We're talking now about maybe a third of the provisions in the bill in this work requirement in the old AFDC program. So things do get done in Washington. And not only that, but as I pointed out, the work support system that has child care, that has changes in the food stamp program, make it easier for working people to get food stamps and so forth, represent scores, literally scores of pieces of legislation were passed by the House and the Senate and signed by a president over the previous decade or even more before welfare reform passed. So sometimes things do get done in Washington. Secondly, immigrants. Illegal immigrants have never qualified for welfare benefits except under emergency circumstances. And if you look at the rolls carefully, occasionally there are illegal immigrants that have false documents that could get on, but generally illegal immigrants are not on welfare, and they weren't on before welfare reform, and there were even stronger provisions after welfare reform. Legal immigrants, they were on welfare in large numbers. In fact, research showed by the Census Bureau showed that households that had an immigrant, not necessarily illegal, but an immigrant, that they were more likely to have one or more welfare benefits than households that had no immigrants. And that was, according to most Republicans and many people in the press, outrageous. And certainly it was outrageous from the perspective of the American public. So welfare reform eliminated welfare benefits from most non-citizens, especially new arrivals in the country. And our system is dramatically different now than it was before, and we have very good administrative data on non-citizens who are on welfare, a whole range of welfare programs, and it has declined dramatically. So this is another case where Congress agreed. By the way, this is one of the things that Clinton opposed the most strongly and mentioned it when he signed a bill that he was going to fix this problem. And we did reach a compromise the next year and fixed one problem with immigrants. But the general provision is still in place. There are way, way fewer immigrants on welfare, a range of welfare programs than in the past. And now third, the most important point that you raised in my estimation is discouraging work. And that was exactly the problem with the welfare system in the past. And in fact, you know, reflect on this a minute. You cannot have a welfare system that doesn't distinguish work, discourage work. If you give things to people, there are people who will accept them and work less or work not at all. So what welfare did was cut right through the problem by saying you have a time limit on your benefits and you have to prepare for work, and if you don't, we will terminate your benefit. And furthermore, we're going to give you some carrots as well. If you get a job on the outside, we're going to give you this wage subsidy through the Earned Income Tax Credit. We're going to help with child care. We're going to cover the kids and so forth with the health insurance and so forth. So the system now, everyone agrees, including the people who didn't like it before, that is much more pro-work and even in a tough, hard-headed way than ever before.
All right. Let's talk with another caller here. Urbana, this is line number two. Hello.
Thank you.
Yes.
I'd like to thank the speaker for refuting the illegal immigrant welfare claim, which is so frequently heard. As he says, illegal immigrants aren't getting welfare. However, I do have some quibbles with some of his statements. Yes, a lot of former welfare people have gotten on into work, but the statistics I've seen show that they actually have marginally more income now than they had when they were on welfare, and their expenses are considerably higher. They have to purchase child support, child care, which, unfortunately, even if they had sufficient money to purchase, it is rarely available in high quality. This, along with the fact that the low-quality child care that they get may well have much to do with the problem we have with education. At least when the mother was at home supervising her children and caring for them, they were in a better position to make use of what educational opportunities they had than they are now with very low quality child care and with a parent away from home for many hours a day. Would you care to comment?
Yes. First, on the point of marginally better total income, not earnings, but total income. I agree with that. I hope I didn't say anything that implied differently. These mothers are better off, and their children are better off, and they're more likely to be out of poverty, but they still have difficulty holding on to their jobs. There are lots of requirements. They're trying to balance two huge balls, as you know, being in the workforce almost full-time and raising their family. So it's a real challenge for these mothers. And they do get low-wage jobs. We know that the average job that they get is about $8.50 or $9 an hour. But they get a lot of these subsidies that I mentioned to you, and if you include the subsidies, they are on average better off. That is for sure. And some of them are much better off, and not a few of them go on to get better jobs. On average, they don't, but there's still a lot of mothers that do that. So the work system is much better, especially because they got their money the old-fashioned way. They earned it. They're much more popular with the public. They say in interviews that they're proud of themselves. And their children are proud of them. So it's a much – even if they had exactly the same amount of money, they earned it, and that makes all the difference.
Good job.
The problem of child care is definitely an issue. I mentioned that before. But I think if you reflect on this, first of all, you have to take account of the fact that we have a number of programs that help these families pay for child care. And in virtually every state, the mothers who actually go on welfare and leave welfare get some support for child care over some period of time. They do generally choose inexpensive child care, especially for children who are under age four. And there are issues with quality in that child care. But lots of Americans use child care. If you want to do something about child care, that should be done separately from welfare. You shouldn't say people shouldn't have to work because we think there's some problems with child care. And not only that, but the problems with child care are not completely clear if you look at averages. Why do I say that? Because there's good evidence that kids that go to child care centers, when they enter the public schools, actually perform a little better when they get to the public schools than kids that did not go to center-based child care. So on the whole, I think child care, there's reason for concern. I think we should spend more money on child care, but it doesn't cancel out the positive benefits of welfare reform and of work.
One of the things I want to get back to is that you did say that, and I'm sure that there are some people who would argue that there are still some families for which welfare reform has not worked. That is, we have some people who get to the point where they're timed out on their benefits, and for a variety of reasons, and you mentioned some of them, they can't find adequate work to support themselves and their families. I think you said maybe it's not as many as people thought, but that there are people like that. What is the situation of these folks, and what, if anything, do you think we should be doing to try to help them?
The number has doubled. I don't recall offhand the actual number, but the number has doubled since 1995. If you define it as mothers who do not have cash welfare, which would be different than in the past because of the requirements in welfare that you could actually lose your benefit if you don't meet the work requirements. So a lot of them do not have cash welfare, and they do not have earnings. So they're kind of caught between the welfare system and the work system. And it's because they have these other problems. And interestingly, research shows that generally if they have just one of the problems that I mentioned, such as a lot of kids and problems with child care or an addiction or a lack of work experience or any of the other barriers, they're usually okay if they just have one of those. It's when they have two or three that the problems really arise. But, yes, we should do more about it. And the key, I think, and this is why it's so hard to do anything or do something successfully, I think the key is casework. We need to have social workers and others who can work with these mothers and help them when these problems arise, help them get services to try to address their problems and encourage them to stay in the workforce or when they lose a job to go back in the workforce. And these caseworkers need to have the ability, if they feel like they're putting pressure on the mothers and the mothers are still not able to stay in the workforce, that they would get their welfare benefit. And this is a very delicate balance here between decisions about whether they should lose their benefit or they should be able to retain their benefit. And generally, it hinges on a decision that only a human could make, which is, yes, they're making a sincere, serious effort to get in the workforce, to stay in the workforce. And under those circumstances, we're going to support this mother with the welfare check
And I think the American public would support that as long as they believe that the system does try to strike that balance. So we do need a new program. It would cost more money. One of my colleagues here at Brookings, Rebecca Blank, has estimated that we could do a pretty good job for around $2.5 billion a year. So we should be doing more.
Let me again introduce our guest for anyone who might just have joined us. Ron Haskins is a senior fellow in the Economic Studies Program and co-director of the Center on Children and Families at the Brookings Institution in Washington. He's also senior consultant at the Annie E. Casey Foundation in Baltimore. He's authored a book on the subject we're talking about here. The book is Work Over Welfare, the Inside Story of the 1996 Welfare Reform Law that was published back in 2006 by Brookings, so at the 10-year anniversary. He was from February to December 2002, senior advisor to the President for Welfare Policy at the White House. And before joining Brookings and Casey, he spent 14 years on the staff of the House Ways and Means Human Resources Subcommittee as a welfare counsel to the Republican staff and then as the subcommittee's staff director. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-2-3.
Hey, before you take another question, can I make a brief comment
on
the last one?
Yeah.
I should have mentioned this. It's interesting that there seems to be an increased level of concern with poverty and with helping low-income working families, I would say, over the past 2 years or so. And this is reflected in opinion polls. It's reflected by the position of all the presidential candidates. It's reflected in news stories, but especially on editorial pages. There's a rising concern with doing more about poverty. And I think that this problem of this group of mothers at the bottom, a lot of people call them disconnected mothers, and I like to call them floundering mothers, I think that that we may get legislation next year in 2009 that will address this problem.
And is this simply because of what's been happening with the economy recently, or is there something more than just that? The fact that it's a response to the fact that maybe a lot of people are having a tough time, and the people who were at the very bottom, the most disadvantaged, are having a very tough time.
Look. The fact is, people at the bottom, say at the 15th percentile of family income and below, are always having a tough time. They always have to be very cautious. And it's always a delicate balance for them how best to husband their resources. But I think that for this group of mothers that I've just described that has doubled, that has neither cash welfare nor earnings, I think that group, it is not primarily related to the economy. The economy could make the problem a little bit worse, but this is a group of people who have difficulties. They have difficulties maintaining an average normal life in an economy that requires a certain level of competence and skill and commitment. And many of them try hard, but they have problems. As I've said, I've mentioned several of them. And many of them have multiple problems, and they find it very difficult to stay in the workforce.
All right, let's talk with someone else. This is a caller in Champaign in line one. Hello.
Hi. Something else I'd like to add to this group of mothers that's having a difficult time is there's a lot of mental health issues surrounding this group of people, too. And I know in this community it's extremely difficult to access mental health care. And the second issue I want to mention, too, is I know I have a lot of clients, patients, who basically have difficulty collecting any child support from the fathers, and it makes it even more complicated if the father moves out of state or if the father is out of state. Evidently, there's from what I hear from the patients, there's very little connection between the states on child support enforcement. So if you could address those issues, too. Thank you.
Okay.
We did not talk about this, but if you read the book, you will find that there's a great deal of attention paid to a federal-state program called the Child Support Enforcement Program. It does have its flaws, but I think you could argue that it's the most efficient program that is run by government. It has enormous scope and power to find fathers and take their money if they don't pay child support voluntarily. And this program was greatly strengthened by the 1996 law. The president mentioned this specifically. When he signed the bill, it was bipartisan from the very beginning. In fact, we worked very closely behind the scenes with the Democratic administration and with many Democratic members of Congress
to strengthen the child support enforcement program as much as we could. Since 1990, between 1996 and 2000, collections from child support more than doubled. And you're right to point out the difficulties with interstate enforcement because you have different states, different jurisdictions, different laws, lots of issues. We greatly strengthened those provisions as well. And interstate collections also have improved greatly, although they're still worse than you have a lower probability of getting money from a father who's out of state than in state. So the child support program is much stronger and more effective, even though there are lots of issues. We could have a whole hour discussion about child support itself. But nonetheless, on balance, I think it's a very strong program, and it definitely has gotten better since welfare reform. The mental health issue is not in that category. First of all, a number of mental health programs are not overly effective. Secondly, we do have many communities, exactly as you point out, that do not have extensive mental health services. So mental health is an issue. I mentioned personality problems. I probably should have your term mental health is much better. But, yes, that is definitely an issue with welfare mothers. It's one of the reasons that some others have trouble staying in the workforce. And it would be good if we could learn to help them more. We are somewhat successful with depression, but other mental disorders, it's often quite difficult, and it's especially difficult to help a mother with other mental disorders, mental health issues, stay in the workforce.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Mahomet next. This line one. Hello.
Hi. At least at one time, someone who is in the Army does not have any money spent for welfare. A divorced mother cannot get the money from the Army. Is that still the case?
No. In fact, we put very strong provisions, by far the strongest ever in the law, so that mothers could get money from or fathers, for whoever has custody of the children, could get money from the mother or father who's still in the service. And every unit in the service has to have a child support officer, and they have to have procedures for withholding the money from the father's paycheck. I haven't seen the numbers lately, but I would not be surprised that the single group that pays the highest percentage of the child support that they owe are servicemen.
Okay. Thank you.
Very strong system.
We have a couple minutes left, maybe 3 minutes or so. We have talked about the fact that when this legislation was passed and signed in 1996, it did indeed have bipartisan support. I'm sure that there were probably people on both sides, maybe Republicans who felt that it didn't go far enough, and maybe Democrats who felt that it went too far. But basically, there were certainly enough to get it passed, and the president signed it. And now, these many years later, it seems that most people would support it. Senator Clinton, for example, it would be kind of hard for her to not support it, but said that she thinks
Obama has supported it too.
And Senator Obama has indeed said mm-hmm. so too. I guess I'm wondering at this point if essentially the consensus is that this was in fact a positive thing. Can you find some people who would find some reason to at this point now 12 years later to argue against it?
I would say that most of its original opponents, especially in the scholarly world who have studied the issue, now give it at least a C or a C+ or a B-, and they think it's much better than they thought it was when they passed it. It still has opponents. There are still people who feel strongly about it. Some of them are in Congress, and there's no question that there are people in Congress who would try to change the law if they could, and on the whole, they are Democrats. And as you know, they now control both the House and the Senate, and if the polls are correct, they will also control the presidency before too long. So it's possible that there could be some changes. Now, notice that Democrats have been in control of the Hill for a year and a half, and they have not introduced major changes in welfare. Nothing major has passed, and nothing major seems to be in the offing. So I think it's likely that there will not be major changes in welfare, but there could be useful legislation of the type we just described, in fact, have referred to throughout this program, and many of your callers have asked about, like more money for child care, a higher quality child care. I think the most important problem are these low-income disconnected mothers that we were concerned about, and I think we might get legislation that addresses them next year. But on the whole, I think welfare reform represents a true change in American social policy, and we are a very distinctive nation in what we expect of people who are poor. We expect them to do everything they can to become self-sufficient.
So I think it's interesting that it seems that on the one hand, as you said, that there are people who say that they're very concerned about the issue of poverty and the government response. At the same time, though, it doesn't seem that welfare really is the kind of hot-button issue that it once was. I guess I'm not exactly sure how those two things go together.
I think that's true, but I think there's not enough appreciation of how effective this approach of expecting people to work and then subsidizing their income with cash benefits and other benefits to improve their living circumstances. It is the most effective thing that we have devised as a nation to reduce poverty. It certainly is not perfect. We still have far too much poverty. But this system of low-wage work plus public benefits is very effective in reducing poverty. The only other thing that we have tried that really has reduced poverty, and this will shock you, is giving money away. And we did that in Social Security. We increased Social Security benefits over a period of, you know, about a half a decade back in the 70s, and now we have the lowest poverty rate among demographic groups. One of the lowest poverty rates is among the elderly, and in most societies throughout history, the biggest poverty rate has been among the elderly, and it's because of Social Security and the generous nature of Social Security benefits. But note this, Americans do not like to give stuff away unless people have earned it, and they feel that Social Security people have earned their benefits because they worked all their life in its insurance program. They paid into the program. But welfare people are often young in their prime earning years. They did not pay anything into the system, so Americans want them to try to work.
Where there, we will have to stop because we're here at the end of the time. We want to say thanks to our guest, Ron Haskins. He is a senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution, where he co-directs the Center on Children and Families. He's also a senior consultant to the Annie E. Casey Foundation. He's the author of the book, Work Over Welfare, The Inside Story of the 1996 Welfare Reform Law. It was published in 2006, so at the 10-year mark, and it's published by the Brookings Institution Press. If you're interested, you can look for that book. And, of course, you can find out other things about Brookings and look at papers and articles on various subjects by going to their website, www.brookings.edu. Mr. Haskins, thanks very much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it, and thanks to your callers as well.